You're listening to The Review, first broadcast on the 12th of January 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Review, your weekly preview and review of the arts here on Monocle 24, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House with me, Emma Nelson and Gillian DeVias.
And coming up on today's programme, we talk new Russian art and Croatian multimedia compositions as we look at what London's galleries have to offer this month.
Also ahead, our music reviewer this week will offer us a wide range of musical treats, including this. I am a perfect man,
and also ahead, our man in Tokyo tells us what you could be doing if you had an hour or two to spare in the city this weekend. Plus, we visit a photography and art bookshop in Lisbon.
There was a photographer who had been doing the PhD in London for the last few years, and he came to me and he said, you know, my dream would be to have a photography bookshop. And I said, well, if you want a partner, maybe we can think about it.
So plenty to look forward to this week on The Review here on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Studio One here at Midori House in London. Good morning, Emma.
Good morning, Gillian. We had a night of all nights.
Have you recovered?
We have. In the name of The Review, ladies and gentlemen, Gillian and I decided that we were going to spend a Friday night in Soho.
Being very cultural and trying to catch up on the films that have been nominated for various different awards, from the BAFTAs to the Oscars. So we had a look at what was on offer and we decided to go together to see Amour.
And it is not necessarily the best way that I would advise anyone to spend a Friday night in Soho if you're looking for fun. It was, however, I'd say one of the finest films I've ever seen.
I was going to say, I mean, I woke up this morning thinking about it and I thought it was such a brave, brave film to face old age head on in all its reality. It's very grim reality.
It's, as Gillian says, it's an incredibly unsparing movie, yet at the same time, I had been concerned beforehand that it would be too
grim,
but it wasn't. It struck a perfect balance of little bits of levity, you know, not laughing in the face of death, but the absurdity of the whole situation was played out very, very, very beautifully and very sensitively. I don't think that there was a spare shot or a spare line or a spare scene. I think everything just was judged absolutely perfectly. I was astonished.
And
by
I
it.
Think the extraordinary thing was it's an incredibly emotional film, but there's no musical soundtrack to it to milk your emotions. There's a lot of silent and natural sounds, taps running, hoovers going, shavers going, except when the music, which has a part of the plot, plays. And I just found it spectacularly pared down and so powerful.
When you say, though, that it was an emotional film, indeed it is an incredibly emotional film because it deals with the most intimate of emotions and the most intimate aspects of a relationship. However, I think before it started, as the lights went down, I turned around to Gillian and said, let's prepare ourselves to sob for the next 2 hours.
No, you're right.
And I think I only got a lump in my throat about twice. Now, maybe it makes me a cool, hard character, but I don't think I am. I think it was just balanced enough so you didn't spend the whole time wailing.
But that was what was so brilliant about it. It really didn't milk the emotions. And the performances, like this morning when I woke up quite early to prepare for the show, but I just had to go back and look at old videos of the artist Jean-Louis Trintignant, Emmanuel Riva, because these were idols. They were incredibly beautiful in their youth. And here they are very bravely showing the grim reality of old age on screen.
And Emmanuel Riva, of course, being the oldest person to be, oldest actress to be nominated for an Oscar in her role as
and rightly
in
so.
a leading role. At 85 years old, it is an absolute tour de force. If you have not seen it yet, we thoroughly recommend you do. You're listening to The Review here on Monocle 24. We talk art now.
Am And we are kicking off today's show with art. So what do Northern Hemisphere galleries do in the depths of winters? At first glance, it seems that the darker, harsher side of life are what comes to the fore. Or perhaps that's a bit of a gloomy point of view.
To help us explore this morass, Ben Luke from the Evening London Evening Standard joins us in the studio. Welcome once again to the review, Ben. Not a great number of big offerings from many of the galleries, apart from perhaps the Saatchi Gallery in London, with its quite astonishing exhibition. Gaiety is the most outstanding feature of the Soviet Union. It is, you know, possibly the longest title I've ever
Yeah, and a deeply, deeply ironic one.
Is it?
It's a grim show. It's a show which very light on gaiety and very, very big on very heavy emotions, dark.
Of course, that's
images, and you know,
that's a quote from Stalin, isn't it?
Yes, it's a Stalin quote.
Yeah,
and I think that's the thing is that what's very interesting is that actually, I think it's a very effective combination of two shows. Actually, you have two floors worth of Saatchi's recent purchases, his own collection of Russian and former Soviet Union art, and then on the top floor you have a foundation. Which has sort of hired the space, a show of 1960s to 1980s art. And so actually what you get is a fairly comprehensive view of the kind of art that's been made in the Soviet Union and after for 50 years.
I found it an upside down way of displaying the exhibition, because
yes.
I started on the bottom, you know, on the ground floor and worked up.
Hmm.
And the more modern exhibition is on the first two floors, and then the top floor, tucked away, jam-packed with art,
yes,
is this astonishing snapshot of what was happening in Moscow between the 1960s and the 1980s. And the exhibition was drawing attention to the fact that Moscow, being so controlled centrally, found itself being artistically controlled centrally as well. So if you wanted to create great art, you went to Moscow. However, wrought through every single image until I think near the end bit where it all starts to go, you know, very overtly political, you get this very sad feeling that people are desperately trying to express themselves and yet they are stuck in other genres of art. You get
yeah.
a feeling that there's a lot of modernism, there's a lot of abstract art, that people are trying to express themselves in whatever means they can.
I think the crucial thing to understand is that in 1932, after Russia had been really at the forefront of modern art in the early part of the 20th century, in 1932, Stalin calls an end to it. He rather like Hitler, views modern art as degenerate. So from 1932 onwards, the progress of modern art stops in Russia, mm. in the Soviet Union. And then you get to this point where basically for another 20, 30 years, there is almost nothing being produced. And then so I feel like the first half of that exhibition is playing catch up. In a way, it's heroic art because it's still being made in a communist totalitarian state. But it's inferior frankly to what's being produced in Europe and the West, which has gathered a whole momentum still, you know. So I think I find that first half of the exhibition rather sad and rather, mm. you know, but quite moving in a way. But then in the second half of the exhibition, it vastly improves, I think, and there is some really stonking stuff. And when it gets quite overtly political and critical, as there is an opening up.
I think there are various elements of the second exhibition that properly stopped me dead in my tracks. One in particular was the large room full of photographs of Russian prisoners, or prisoners from the Soviet Union, who have, while incarcerated, have tattooed themselves by the most gruesome means possible. And the irony is that they are using their own bodies as expressions of political protest, because obviously given no other means to express themselves, they have chosen to use their bodies as canvases. And it is a very brutal, but it's incredibly intimate portrait of how people, when they are stuck behind bars and work together, find the most astonishing means of self-expression.
Exactly, in a whole world of symbolism, which when you look at it, you don't know really much of what's going on here. You have, for instance, if they have crosses on their knuckles, it means the number of times they've been in prison. If they have a skull, it means they're a leader in the pack, as it were, of the prisoners. If they have a cat, it means they're a thief. So there's a whole world of symbolism that's conjured up by these images. And it must be said that these images were made essentially for documentary purposes. Vasiliev, who's the photographer, was essentially a news photographer. But when you look at them, elevated to high art in the Saatchi Gallery, blown up to an enormous scale, they are astonishingly beautiful in a strange way. They're brutal, but they are extraordinarily beautiful. And in those galleries, as very often is the case in Saatchi's displays, they just sing on the walls. I mean, it is just an extraordinary, shocking room to confront as you walk into the show.
When you scan the different rooms and you look at the contemporary work, is there a common denominator? I mean, do you find at its heart that contemporary artists still feel they have to do work about Russia and the state of Russia?
Very much so. There is this constant theme that these Russian artists are looking at their situation. And also, you know, that situation is deeply complex. There is a sort of myth that post the Soviet Union, suddenly everything got better. And a lot of the art here is saying, well, hang on, you know. I mean, the classic example is Boris Mikhailov's photographs. And I have to say, the photographs in the Saatchi show really are the best work. So you have three rooms of photography and they make it worth going alone. Some of the painting, I have to say, is very uneven. But Boris Mikhailov's photographs of Kharkov in Ukraine, where he went back after the fall of the Soviet Union and he found, for the first time, homeless people. And lots of homeless people. And he then set about photographing them. And I have to say, these are some of the most uncomfortable images anyone will ever see. They are deeply uncomfortable and even more uncomfortable because the artist made a transaction with these people. He's not just documenting them. He paid them to perform, to remove their clothes, for instance. I mean, there's one particularly sort of harrowing image of genital warts, for instance, and you know it's this whole procession of images which just shock you time and again, and I think that is that places you in a very uncomfortable position, but it is an attempt to look at post-Soviet Union countries and say, well, hang on, you know.
I found that a horrible room to be in. I didn't spend much time in that room because once I got the point that he was trying to make, I thought, please, let's move on from this. It's a collection of about 12, again, enormous photographs of people who, as you say, Ben, are homeless. But so as a result, they have that glazed, dead look about their eyes because life has left them, and so they're resorting to whatever means you can do when they're homeless. So they look, many of them look intoxicated. And what this man has done has, I would say, exploited them to make them the most degraded as possible. So you have these people who, clearly for money, have agreed to expose their most intimate parts in the name of art. And at one point I thought, okay, this is a very good exhibition insofar as a running theme that you find is the relationship of an individual and the effect that the state can have upon this individual. This, I thought, was a step too far, and I didn't spend time in there at all. I hated it, actually.
Yeah, no, I think that there are very many artists who do this, actually, and it's an interesting whole area of cultural activity where the artist is not just a distanced observer. They are a participator in the whole process of depicting people in often very vulnerable situations. I think Mikhailov is both a humanitarian and somebody who wants to make a kind of controversial statement. So I'm not quite so... I find that I can look at these things and I can, in a way, admire them. But I know that sort of area of discomfort, and it's an area a lot of artists, the Chapman brothers, for instance, are working in, where you feel... We feel you're placed in a difficult moral space.
5 years ago, Saatchi devoted his gallery to the exploration of new Chinese art, and that became a very, very important exhibition. Now, do you think that this Russian exhibition will do the same for Russian art as what happened to the Chinese exhibition?
Well, I think one of the things about Saatchi is he's a brilliant reflector. He's just the most high-profile reflector of what's going on quite often. Yes, he leads sometimes, but I actually think sometimes he's just documenting a wider interest. There is a hell of a lot of Russian art going on in London at the moment. There are galleries devoted to it. One of them, Calvert 22, we'll discuss in a minute. There is a very high-profile series of Russian collectors in London. You know, there's a real sense in which both on the collecting side and in terms of the making side within the art world, Russia is very much on the up.
Well, let's move to cover 22. Croatian contemporary artist.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about this exhibition.
It's called Unknown Heroine, and the subject is Sanja Ivković, who is a Croatian artist born in 1949. And Unknown Heroine may be overstressing it somewhat, but she's certainly an artist who's worthy of discussion, sort of worthy of investigation. She has suddenly been thrust right to the top of the art world. She had a show at the Museum of Modern Art in New York last year, after many years of being an important, if cult, figure. But I think it's really worth looking at these shows. One is at Calvert 22 in the East End, and the other is at the South London Gallery. And I think what's really important about these shows is that they are very much of their time. They reflect conceptual art in the 1970s. But at the same time,
In the former, what was Yugoslavia then?
Yes, exactly. But also, they are incredibly relevant. The way that Sanja Ivković works, particularly in the whole area of investigating the portrayal of women in the media, they seem incredibly relevant today. And walking around the show, I was minded that, yes, some of the graphics of the adverts that she might refer to look dated, but the themes are astonishingly vivid today.
So who is the unknown heroine in Ivković's exhibition? Is it her because we all now are falling in love with her for the first time, or is it the exploration of female identity, which is what she pretty much specializes in?
Yes, I think woman is the unknown heroine in a way. And if you say to somebody a feminist artist, a lot of people will recoil and think, oh God, this is going to be sledgehammer stuff. But I think Sanja Ivković works in a very subtle way. The images where she uses adverts and then takes an advert from a magazine and then places it next to an image that she's found in her private albums, where she's just gone through her private photographs of herself and found an image of herself which relates to these images in the adverts. And it basically is a very simple way of saying this is real woman and this is idealized or fetishized or sexualized woman. And actually you see this all the way through the show. You see it with gossip column images, for instance. I mean, again, you know, we're so surrounded by gossip columns today. And it's very interesting to see in 1975 Ivković looking at gossip columns and saying this is an absurd idea of what life might be like for a person in the public eye, and as I say, these hold a lot of truth today.
Her work is very much a commentary on media and society, and much of it was done when Tito was ruling. Do you find her work was stronger during the difficult times in her early career than it is now?
I think that's true. I think there's also a sense that she was freer than a lot of artists were in the former communist bloc. At that time, Tito's rule was totalitarian, but it didn't have that same, there wasn't that same level of censorship. She does refer to Tito in those works too, and she, in fact, there's a very interesting piece called Triangle, which is all about Tito visiting Zagreb and her setting up a performance for security guards, basically. So she goes out onto her balcony and she knows that opposite her on a building is somebody surveying the scene, and downstairs below on the street is a policeman, and she makes a performance for the guy on the top of the building where she takes a book and a glass of whiskey and she simulates masturbation, and she knows that sometime there's going to be a little bit of she's going to hear about this from these two security guys. And sure enough, 18 minutes after the performance begins, there's a knock on the door asking her to refrain from doing what she's doing. So she's playful as well as sort of hard hitting in her work. And I think this is a show which really rewards a lot of time spent on it. But I agree with you that actually the later work seems to lack the kind of power of some of the earlier pieces. The pieces in the 70s, I do feel, are the very strongest in the show.
And that is Sanja Ivković at the South London Gallery until the 14th of February this year in London. Let's turn finally, Ben, to I think we mentioned the fact that the Saatchi exhibition was dark and gory. Well, not gory, but dark at least. One exhibition that has just finished in Paris, but the artist is moving to London now to open in Mayfair next month, is Abdel Abdesemed. His exhibition in the Pompidou Centre, Je suis innocent, was doesn't hold back, does it? Tell us a little bit more about it.
He's it's interesting. We were talking about Mikhailov's photographs placing you in an uncomfortable moral space. So too does Adel Abdesemed's work. It's a very broad-ranging work. It takes the form of sculpture, of photography, of film and video, of performance. But yes, he. I think it's very interesting. I interviewed him last month in Paris, and he said to me in that interview that I asked him if he felt his work was pessimistic, and he said, no, it's not pessimistic. The world is negative. I'm positive. The very act of creating art is a positive act. It's the world that's negative.
It's very violent stuff, though, isn't it?
Yeah, it can be very violent, and particularly towards animals, which has always caused a very problematic element in his work. He went to Mexico and filmed animals being slaughtered, and made a very uncompromising film about it. He's somebody who always works on the edge. He's very provocative. He really wants to play with the view. He wants to sort of question their intelligence, but I think sometimes he steps over the edge and it becomes about provoking and controversy, you know.
I mean, we were looking at some of the work that's on display at the Pompidou. I wonder if you can describe some of it and explain, you know, why he is in a way perhaps as shocking. Or...
Yes, well, I think the work that really made the biggest impact on me was a film, a very short film of a woman breastfeeding a pig and a piglet, and it wasn't just the imagery that was sort of disturbing. It was the sound as well, and it was this sort of 20-second film. Really,
and what
really
was
short
he thing. Trying to say with that?
Well, I think he's interested in the grotesque. I think he's also very interested in and that makes me off. That very much makes me think about things like Hieronymus Bosch and Bruegel. You know, this sort of very extreme, sort of almost gothic quality to
the
his
playfulness
work.
Of hell. It's quite
well,
an astonishing idea. I'm not entirely. I would hasten to say I'd probably prefer Bosch and Bruegel than a 20-second film of a piglet breastfeeding. It was
and breastfeeding, not its mother pig.
It was one of those things that made me giggle with discomfort. But I wasn't 100% convinced by it. I saw the other images that we've been presented with are of the crumpled cone, nose cone of a plane and a burnt out car, yeah, and a crucifix made of barbed wire. And I thought, I know where this man's thought process has come from.
Yeah.
Where I was astonished in the Saatchi exhibition by the surprising nature of the art that was on offer. I thought that Abdesemed was not necessarily too obvious, but I kind of understood it a bit too quickly.
Yes, I think this is the thing. Actually, the best of his work really does hit you hard and then enter into a sort of more subtle area. And a lot of that will be to do with his North African origin. He's Algerian. So I think when his show opens at David Zwerner in February in London, I think there'll be a different aspect to his work. And I think that will be unveiled in a really interesting way.
A lot of it is quite conceptual, but he has caught the attention of some really high-profile collectors like Pino. What is the market for his work?
Well, I think he's got a very strong market. He's just one of these artists that is showing all over the world. He's attracting. There is that element of provocation which a lot of collectors like. You know, it's direct, it's hard-hitting, and that's what a lot of collectors want. They want their collection to be strident, to be dramatic, and I think he offers that.
Ben Luke from the London Evening Standard, thank you very much indeed for joining us in the studio. Hopefully next time you come in we'll go for something a little bit more cheery. That really was a dark and gruesome collection of art to see, but it is a lot of it well worth seeing. Out of those three, which one would you recommend?
Well, I would say Sanya Vekovic was probably my favourite of the three. So go and see those two shows.
Thank you very much indeed, Ben. You're listening to The Review on Monocle 24.
Section D is Monocle 24's show about design. Each week we take you on a whistle-stop tour of the people and places making a splash in the world of craft, architecture, graphics, fashion and retail.
How do you explain the value of design? What can we do to make clients and designers work better together?
On the latest episode, we talk to Selfridge's creative director, Alana Weston, who's creating a bit of peace and quiet in her retail emporium. We head over to Vancouver, where architect Michael Green tells us how the city's skyline might soon be filled with skyscrapers made from wood. And back in London, designer Richard Seymour teaches us the importance of not overlooking the unimportant.
When you fix something that's been broken forever, then you get a massively positive response.
That's Section D with Hugo MacDonald, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
And you're listening to The Review here on Monocle 24 with me, Gillian Tobias, and Emma Nelson.
Time now to hear from our associate editor, Nelly Gacheva, to hear some cultural treats she's dug out from around the world for us this weekend.
This weekend, the Piper Gallery in London's West End placed host to the work of London-based artist Martin McGinn. Entitled Volume 1, the exhibit displays colourful paintings reproducing art history books as still life. Volume 1 is at the Piper Gallery until the 8th of February. In Taipei, the Sui Sui Institute hosts a new exhibition entitled Medium, a collaboration of Japanese designer Naoto Fukasawa and photographer Tamatsu Fuji. The exhibition showcases Fukasawa's classic design pieces and Fuji's collaborative photos of Fukasawa designs. Open Monday to Sunday from 10 a.m. to 19:30, Medium is on until the 10th of November. Jiro Dreams of Sushi is finally hitting screens in the UK this weekend. New York-born director David Gelb's artfully rendered documentary follows the story of 85-year-old sushi chef Jiro Ono. The feature focuses on his intimate 10-seat restaurant in Tokyo, the first of its kind to receive 3 Michelin stars, and there is an 8-month waiting list for reservations if you are thinking of swinging by. Jiro Dreams of Sushi is now at cinemas across the UK. Ankara's Siyah Beyaz Gallery welcomes the latest works by award-winning local artist Ali Kotan with an exhibit called Have We Taken Refuge Within Timelessness? On display are paintings from Kotan's White series, which has been in the making for the past 2 years. The collaboration between the gallery and the painter dates back to 1988. Since then, the artist has won 6 regional art awards and has had over 20 solo exhibitions. The show is on until the 13th of February. And finally, if you happen to be in Germany for the next couple of days, we recommend you check out one of Coldspeg's gigs. Following the success of her I Predict a Graceful Expulsion album, the London-based singer-songwriter plays a collection of dates across Germany in the coming week, starting today in Hamburg. Go to coldspegs.com for more dates. And now let's hear Winter Solstice. For Monocle, I'm Nelly Gacheva.
And that was Winter Solstice by Coldspecs, ending that report there by Nelly Gacheva. Coldspecs are playing tonight in Hamburg. They're in Munster on Monday. And more of their tour dates can be found on their website, coldspecs.com.
Time now for our weekly music review. Today, I'm delighted to say we're joined in the studio by someone who can only really be described as rather a busy man.
Joe Muggs has been a DJ, producer, even a performance poet. Now he is a music journalist and talent scout. He's also a founding member of the Arts Desk website. He's the dubstep and bass editor of Mixmag. He's made compilations for the Ministry of Sound and Big Data Records and helps various record labels build international profiles.
But luckily for us, despite this hectic schedule, he's managed to squeeze us in today. Welcome to Studio One, Joe. Thank you very much indeed for coming to talk to us on Monocle 24. What are you up to at the moment?
At the moment, I'm actually just trying to piece myself together a bit because... nearing 40, I'm not really the raver that led me to this kind of work in music anymore. But last night I was actually doing my job and was at XOYO in Shoreditch until 3 something AM.
Well, you
and
DJ.
What was there?
Was the return of LFO, one of the sort of foundational British rave techno producers, who's been at it for well over 20 years, and he's doing his live electronic set. But unfortunately, he was on between 2 and 3 a.m. So stand there pretending that I was really raving
in the course of duty. I do want to ask you this. You have very nobly told us that you're approaching 40. Do you still get a lot of people at 40 going out? Because we come from that generation, and I don't think the fact that you get older makes you stop wanting to go out.
It
makes you physically slightly
makes
you physically slightly less capable, perhaps, and you might have family constraints, but
Absolutely. You
still want to go out and get out there. Is there a large swathe of people in their 40s still going out?
100% there is. I mean, the most obvious manifestation of it is festivals like the Big Chill and now Camp Bestival, which, you know, is set up for people with kids. And they're able to kind of, you know, you'll see mums and dads in the rave tent. They'll have the silent, the headphone rave tent, the silent disco, and there'll be people in there with the kids asleep in pushchairs at 1 a.m. or whatever, and, you know, the mums and dads are dancing around the pushchairs.
And you also find the great DJs from, you know, the early 90s, the likes of Sasha, who have kids and who travel around the world and who are still doing the circuit there. I mean, how old are the DJs who are still pulling in the crowds? Are they pushing 50?
More than. I mean, you know, one of the... David Rodigan, the great reggae DJ, is tearing up festivals. He's a dance floor destroyer, and he shows absolutely no sign of slowing down. I'm not sure how old he is, but I'm trying to think. You know, even early 80s DJs, Danielle Bardoli, who was the originator of Italo disco, cosmic disco, in the early 80s, is still on the circuit. So
we build you as talent scout. Where do you go looking for some of the really original sounds and artists?
Internet.
Joe Muggs, thank you for joining us on today's room.
It's everywhere. I mean, you know, it's musicians introduce you to musicians is the real answer. And because, you know, everyone's online all the time and I've got my iPhone in my pocket and so on, you know, I will come out of here and I'll look at Facebook and there will be links to 10 tunes that I haven't heard by people I haven't heard of. I mean, there's the proliferation, which stops people earning that much because there's so much out there, but it also means that there's just this constant flood, and so the job is being a filter for that.
It's a question that we've asked of talent scouts who've come into the review several times. Because of this proliferation of music, how do you sort out the wheat from the chaff?
That's an incredibly difficult question, and it has to be instinct more than anything. You just have to... keep buggering on, as Winston Churchill said, through this storm, you know, through this snowstorm of information. Sorry about that. And you know, trust in your hard-won judgment to pick up a few good things. And you know stuff will fall by the wayside and you just have to not cry about it.
Well, we're going to sample one of your instincts here. You've chosen a track to play in. This is Chunking, I Got a Feeling. We'll have a listen and then we'll talk to you a little bit about this track. Shapes shift in constellation.
And that track was called I Got a Feeling by Chunking, a three-piece formed in Brighton, and the choice of today's guest reviewer, Joe Muggs, a journalist and talent scout. Joe, why did you choose to bring that track into us today?
This one was not a difficult decision. I actually used to be in Chunking. So
shameless.
Completely shameless.
We love them.
But, I mean, I'm talking over 10 years ago, very early lineup.
Are you trying to get back into the group?
the real reason that I chose them, aside from the fact that it's a lovely tune, is that this, I mean, one day the story will be written, one day the biography of this band will be written, and it's got some fairly eye-popping bits in it, but I just admire their tenacity more than anything else, because they've been through the music business ringer in so many different ways, just like certain disastrous choices by record labels and they've had huge success in certain things. They've had like major tracks featured on US TV dramas and so on, you know, all these things that are the mark of success, and yet somehow they've worked with Richard X, who produced the Sugar Babes, you know, really interesting pop producer, all these kind of things. But, you know, I'm guessing.
So why do you think they will? Do you think they will always be condemned to the outskirts of mainstream music, or do you think they, you know, they will once one day get through it?
This is a very interesting question, and things are so gloriously unpredictable in the industry these days. You know, there are so many different opportunities to go around the standard process of being discovered in quotes and making it and so on. And what they've done is, having been through all this, they kind of laid low for a bit. I don't know if they ever officially split up, but reduced from when I was in the band originally, there were seven members. They got down to a core of two by the time of their last album. One day the story will be written. That's all I'm saying. But they've done this new album, which is at the moment completely unreleased. This is an exclusive.
So where do you hear them now being played? Do they feature in any DJ sets anywhere?
You will hear the occasional people play them. They're on a lot of chill out compilation type albums. You know, the more sort of educated, eclectic type DJs you'll once in a while hear a chunking track pop up. Soundtracks are more likely. Soundtracks and in the background in hotels, you know, you'll get these bespoke music services. They're well known to the sort of people who provide atmospheric music for things and so on. So
they were formed in Bristol.
Brighton. And,
Brighton. But yes. There's quite an indie music scene there. There certainly was then. How's the scene there now?
In Brighton, it's always been. When I moved to Brighton in 1992, I went to Sussex University there, and I was like drawn there by the fact that it was bohemian and the club scene and the fact that there were bands everywhere. And then it really very quickly dawned on me that no one made it out of Brighton. Because it's like this, because it's so bohemian, everyone's having a really good time there. You know, it is a party town and it's a student town and everyone has such a great time. But it's a small town. It's very insular. And actually, you know, you can be big in Brighton and not get out of there. That changed when Fatboy Slim came along. I think he kind of like opened up the doors, and a few bands from Brighton did start making it. But it still has that sense that it drags people down, because people just have a good time by the seaside.
Let's move on to your second choice, BJ Smith and Umi Says. It's a cover. Benjamin James Smith has been around for quite a while, working under various disguises. We'll talk about that in just a moment, but let's hear a little bit of the track. I am a perfect man.
BJ Smith, or Benjamin James Smith, with Umi Says. I mean, what a gorgeous texture to his voice. Tell us about him.
That's beautiful. He's just someone who I've been vaguely aware of on the Balearic stroke new disco scene. He's collaborated with a few sort of slightly better known people, Crazy P and one of Can. I can't remember which member of Can, but he has a psychedelic rock band which he plays in. This is an example of the social media kind of discovery that I was talking about, because I got sent this for no other reason than that I'd become sort of involved over months in Twitter banter with Phil Cooper, who runs the New Northern Soul label that this is on, who's a bit of a rave veteran and you know, really good DJ, and you know, no professional capacity whatsoever. We just kind of bounced off each other on Twitter, and then when this came along, this EP, it's two cover versions of songs by hip hop acts. So this one's by Mos Def, and the B-side as a cover of a song by The Far Side. And he'd signed this and he said, oh, we've got a video, and would we like an exclusive for the arts desk on the video and so on. So, you know, it just came out of that sort of idle connection that gets built.
He's also an animator. What was the video like? Did the animation come through in the video?
It's very pretty. I mean, it's a very, very simple. It's just a kind of psychedelic drawing, and it shows the process of drawing. It's like something you used to see on Tony Hart, Take Heart or something.
Joe, I'm afraid we have to move on to our final track, War Snare, Murderous Times, featuring Fille de la Lune. Tell us a little bit more about this track and why you've chosen it.
Which one is this, sorry?
This is War Snare.
This, I know very, very little about the act, but the label Seclusias is from Philadelphia, run by two US dubstep stroke grime DJs, two of the very early adopters of this kind of British bass music, Starkey and Dev 79.
This is what you're specialising in the in at the moment, isn't it? Dubstep and
this,
grime.
This is pretty much, yeah. I'm doing a big grime compilation for Big Dada Records at the moment. I've always, you know, I'm of the rave generation, as we were talking about earlier, and I always loved the stuff with heavy bass, like LFO, who I went to see last night. And so when dubstep came along, it was a no-brainer for me. This is what I always loved about rave music anyway.
We were talking about dubstep before we came on air in the office and trying to work out where you could A, listen to dubstep now, and B, talent shows are now, the competitors are now doing dubstep versions of songs. Mm-hmm. Has that killed dubstep?
Dubstep has been pronounced dead every month since 2005. I mean, someone will say this has killed it, going to America has killed it, certain drug use has killed it, certain difference in the sound has killed it, and yet it just keeps
going.
It's there, you know. It's now as much of a staple as house music or hip hop or anything was. You know, I don't think it's going anywhere at all.
Joe, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. Before we move on to listening to a clip of War Snare, let me thank you. Let us both thank you. That was Joe Muggs, journalist, talent scout, member of the Arts Desk, founding member of the Arts Desk website, DJ, dubstep and bass editor of Mixmag. Like I say, a very busy man. Our thanks to him for joining us on today's review. Let's hear from War Snare.
Thank you. What I feel, not a single breath don't move me to absorb it. It's dry, but the heat is scarce. Now don't take me back. There's nothing left for me out here.
And that was War Snare, Murderous Times, featuring Fille de la Lune, the final choice of today's musical reviewer. Guest Joe Muggs, the DJ, producer, journalist and talent scout.
Time now to cross over to one of our favourite cities, Tokyo, to hear what's coming up over the next couple of days. Kenji Hall is there to guide us through it.
It's the beginning of a new year, and in Japan, that means sumo and kabuki. The January Grand Sumo Tournament gets underway on Sunday the 13th. The first of six tournaments this year, the January contest runs for 15 days in Tokyo and will feature the two yokozuna, or grand champions, Hakuho and Haruma Fuji. Also not to be missed is this month's New Year Kabuki performance. It features the young and popular Ebizo Ichikawa, who leads a cast in The Encounter of the Soga Brothers and Their Father's Killer, as well as other acts at Asakusa Public Hall through January 27th. There's plenty of buzz about a new film from veteran Japanese film director Yoji Yamada. Tokyo Kazoku, or Tokyo Family, is Yamada's homage to Yasujiro Ozu's Tokyo Story, a family drama set in post-disaster Japan. The film hits the big screen on January 19th. For thought-provoking art exhibitions, it's hard to beat the Mori Art Museum in Roppongi Hills. The museum, on the 53rd floor of Mori Tower, is now showing the work of one of Japan's hottest contemporary artists, Makoto Aida. This is Aida's first solo museum show. His work casts Japanese society in a grotesque, erotic, and humorous light. The exhibition runs through March 31st. For another take on modern Japan, there's an exhibition titled Somewhere Between Me and This World at the Tokyo Metropolitan Museum of Photography. This exhibition features five photographers all in their 30s and early 40s who use their medium to ask what a moribund economy and a disaster have done to the nation's psyche. The exhibition ends on January 27th. For Monocle, I'm Kenji Hall in Tokyo.
And you're listening to The Review here on Monocle 24, where after this short break, we'll be getting some reading recommendations from one of Lisbon's most charming bookstores. Stay with us.
You're listening to Monocle 24. Join us at 2200 hours London time and end the day with the Monocle Daily, live every weekday.
Welcome back. It's Saturday and you're listening to The Review with me, Gillian Tobias and Emma Nelson.
We end today's programme with books, and today we decided to get out of the studio and head to Portugal to visit one of the city's most intimate photography and art bookstores, Stedt Livros. It's hidden away behind an architect's office, and since its opening a year and a half ago, lovers of the printed image ranging from hardcover to locally photocopied fanzines finally have somewhere to browse classics and future greats in central Lisbon.
Sima Tariq rifle through the store's bestsellers with co-owner Philippa Valdaris.
In late 2010, I was co-organizing the first photography book fair in Lisbon. And in 3 days, we managed to have 1,000 people going in a very rainy weekend to a not very central part of Lisbon. And so I realized there was a market for people who were looking for photography books and couldn't find them, because in the last few years all the art bookshops in Lisbon closed or stopped being about art.
Curator and lecturer Filipe Valadares is standing in the one-room bookstore she co-owns with photographer Paulo Catrica. Stedt Livros, based in a former 18th century back kitchen in an old building downtown, is the result of their desire to give photography lovers in the Portuguese capital an alternative to online shopping or annual book fairs.
There was a photographer who had been doing the PhD in London for the last few years, and he came to me and he said, you know, my dream would be to have a photography bookshop. And I said, well, if you want a partner, maybe we can think about it. And then next January, we were having meetings and starting to see where can we bring books for, because it's quite expensive to be in a very central area of Lisbon. We found some friends, architects, that had a first floor near Chiado. And so they lent us a room there. We were staying in an 18th century kitchen. And it's our space since we began. So what we do is we have to do lots of events outside the kitchen. And we do lots of fairs, and we do lunches, and we do talks on photography and photography books. So our idea is a little bit to bring outside books, international books, to Portugal and to take Portuguese books outside as well.
Stedt's niche business has been gaining recognition within Portugal as a one-stop shop for quality photography publishing. And they have their expert curation to thank for that.
We don't only have the new things, we have some old things as well. From Steidl we have lots of things from Germany, and we have from Mac, the English publisher, some editions from Portugal. Pierre van Kleist is a Portuguese editor. Ghost is another Portuguese editor we work a lot with. Whenever we go to book fairs, we try to buy from all sorts of books. I mean, we can buy Walter Koenig, or we can buy from these kids doing a book for themselves.
The shelf-lined space, with zines, magazines and films stocked in the former stove area, has a huge central table showcasing recent acquisitions. Philippa's latest bestsellers range from hardcover collector's items to stapled together personal projects.
The History of European Photography was launched last year by Bratislava Fotofo, which is the Museum of Photography in Bratislava. And they propose a new view over the history of European photography. Each country speaks for himself. So they invite historians in each country to make a text proportional to the photographers that are known from that country. And so they started with the first volume. It's from 1900 to 1938, and it's going to go until the year 2000. And so in the end of those, we're going to have a new view over what was the several different Europes were doing in photography. So this is one interesting book that actually costs 99 euros, but it's been quite sold here. And for instance, from MEC, one of our best sellers has been one of the last editions, which is from Luigi Ghidi, Kodachrome, which is a facsimile from 1978, I think. And that was really one of the things that people were looking for in the last few months. And for instance, Fabrique Proprio, which is the book about design of Portuguese semi-industrial confectionery. And it's about Portuguese sweets, and it's a quite interesting book. Or not really a photography book, but of course, there are some photographers involved. Felipe Casaca, a Portuguese photographer, who did this book on his own without a publisher, so self-published. And it's about a Chinese town, holidays from internal China tourism. Maybe I can talk about some other things that are not really photography, but cross the lines. For instance, there's a fanzine made by João Pedro Val e Nuno Alexandre Ferreira called P-Town, which is a fanzine with a t-shirt, and it's about a province town connection with a beach city here in Portugal called Caparica.
I asked Filipa if she thought independent publishing was on the rise in Portugal, and if that reflected positively on her business.
Because there are no options to do institutional or other editors publishing your books, young artists have to publish by themselves. Sometimes you do a fanzine, sometimes you do a hardcover book. It depends on the money you can get. It doesn't have to be a less interesting object because it costs less money. You just have to measure and to equalize which images are good for that kind of format that you can afford. It's strange because I really can't say what the future is going to be. Nobody can, but it's a very complicated economical situation in Portugal. But we've been open for a year and a half now, and the truth is each month it's better than the one before. We work a lot, and so things have been good, but we're always trying to find new ways. When you have a crisis, you tend to have to find new solutions.
As STET goes from strength to strength in uncertain times, its status as a microcosm on creative publishing in Portugal is surely something to celebrate. For Monocle in Lisbon, I'm Simon Tarek.
And if you happen to find yourself in Lisbon, you can find STET Livros on Rua do Norte. That brings us to the end of our Saturday review. For now, it's goodbye from all of us here at Midori House. Our show today was produced by Katie Bilboa and researched by Ed Lucas. Our studio manager was Toby Hammond. Our thanks to them.
And don't forget, there's more Culture on Monday with Robert Bound. Here's what's coming up on next week's show.
On the latest edition, we hear about plans across LA for Pacific Standard Time 2013, absorb ourselves in a minute of sound from an Indian wedding, and meet the men on a mission to preserve ancient songs of Papua New Guinea, which are on the brink of extinction.
That's Culture with Robert Bound, which you can catch at 1900 hours London time on Monday.
We're handing back to Georgina with the weekend edition next, where you can catch our pick of the week's best Monocle 24 stories, guests and features on The Curator. And don't forget to tune into the Monocle Weekly, which will be on air Sunday at midday London time.
But from the review, goodbye.